humidity 85%, 59 degrees under a sunny sky in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at Jack and Drea, jackanddrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part one. We are spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with one of America's most capable novelists, Olin Steinhauer. He has a number of best-selling novels to his credit, and his most recent novel, a political thriller of sorts, is called The Middleman. And perhaps you have read some of his previous books, including The Cairo Affair, An American Spy, The Tourist, Victory Square, Liberation Movements. In this latest book called The Middleman, Olin Steinhauer paints a very unsettling picture indeed of a massive movement called the Massive Brigade, which is actually a left-wing movement that is intent on trying to gain attention for its causes in whatever ways are necessary, including violence. And among the most dramatic moments in the novel is very early on, when some 400 people from across the country walk away from their own daily lives, leaving everything behind, in a sense, disappearing into the underground as part of this thing called the Massive Brigade. And the question is, what are their intentions? What are they planning to do? And whatever those intentions are, can they be thwarted? And someone from the FBI is particularly on the case, and we follow much of this story through her particular eyes. The book is very, very well written. It is one of those books that has you on the edge of your seat, and I'm very excited to speak with the author. The book is published by Minotaur Books. Again, it's called The Middleman, and Olin Steinhauer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
I would love to just briefly hear a little bit about how you found yourself in this particular genre. What, in a sense, sort of initially drew you to it? And were there things from your own personal background that would sort of explain why this is such a good match?
Well, when you ask in terms of genre, I think you mean the spy and
right.
sort of genre that I ended up with. Originally, when I was younger, I wanted to be just like James Joyce. So this is a real shift from that. And when I was in grad school, I found myself reading a lot of very self-consciously literary fiction. And as a result, I ended up developing, oddly enough, this prejudice against genre. And it wasn't until I left grad school that I picked up first some Raymond Chandler. And that shocked me. I didn't realize how well done some genre fiction was. And my first book is probably just it's really an homage to him, The Bridge of Sighs. And then after that, of course, it's, you know, there's nothing original about this. I picked up Jean Le Carré, and that really settled me into a different path. I'd always been interested in international relations and sort of the secret side of how things are done. The people in the smoky rooms and things like that. And so this, when I found particularly Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which I think is John le Carré's greatest book, I found something that wasn't just a thrilling and, you know, mesmerizing spy story, but it's also a great social novel. And I saw how you could use genre to comment on the world at large in very interesting and, to me, very literary ways.
One of the things that intrigues me about this novel, and I think it's fair to say that this is an accomplishment in some of your previous novels as well, and is probably one of the trickiest challenges in this genre, is to try to come up with scenarios that are truly shocking and yet plausible. Because I think I think it's one thing to dream up something that's really, really shocking, but it's probably simpler for to dream up shocking things that are also far-fetched, beyond the realm of reality or likelihood. And dreaming up something truly shocking that also feels like it could really happen, which I think is something you have managed to create here, is quite an accomplishment. Talk for a moment about the kind of things that you have to think about in order to create that kind of spell in this sort of a book.
Well, to my mind, it's, you know, every sort of fiction, whether it's fantasy fiction or literary fiction or, you know, whatever the genre, whatever the focus is, it's all about world building. So no matter what you're doing, you're trying to create a world parallel to this one that people can believe. And it's in the details, and particularly in the characters. So if I have a character doing something that's only hardly plausible, what I have to do is get into that character and put them in a situation where if you were there, you would feel like you have no choice but to do that same thing. And so to me, it's really all about sort of character work and sort of setting the environment just right so that whatever happens makes sense. I mean, the nice thing about a lot of espionage or say mystery fiction is that you, a lot of times you start with the ridiculous thing, and then the rest of the book is to explain how this ridiculous thing could be plausible, which is sort of fun way to go about it. But it's just, you can't give your character short shrift and expect really anything to be believable. And that's my general approach to that.
My understanding is that you first began work on this novel back in 2013. And I read an interesting essay that you wrote in which you talked about how this novel, in a sense, was nearly derailed by some of the dramatic events in this country over the last couple of years. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about and exactly what kind of a derailment of sorts we're talking about here.
Right. In the original draft of it, which was flawed in so many ways, would have had to have been rewritten anyway. But one of the things in it is that the Massive Brigade is a much darker presence in the original book. You had said that they resort to violence. In the original version, they resorted to violence very easily. And what I feared, once the political climate changed, you know, after I'd written one draft of this, is that this story would be taken by people who are terrified of the left as sort of evidence. Oh, look, this is what the left would do if you gave them free rein. And I had to rethink it. I was making something that was a shoot 'em up sort of thriller. And then I realized, wait a minute, there's actually, and I don't generally have this feeling with my books, or I haven't had this fear with my other books. But in this case, I had the fear that it would have social repercussions that I did not like. So I had to go back and sort of rethink my characters, which, you go back to the plausibility question. One of the flaws in that one is, in the original draft, is that I was going for something that was sort of full of firecrackers And I wasn't actually spending enough time developing the characters to find out why they would do what they do. And as a result, I mean, partly it was the election of Trump, and partly it was realizing that I had rushed through something to make me realize, okay, I have to recast this leftist movement. And so while, yes, violence does occur, it's not their go-to method for achieving social change.
In this same essay, which I was referencing before, you talk about having, for quite a long time, a real interest in the radical terror groups of the 1970s. I wonder if you could talk about that interest and what in particular was intriguing to you about some of these groups from the 1970s, and to what extent that really informs the way in which you crafted this novel and in particular created this thing called the Massive Brigade.
Yes, well, I've always had a certain amount of interest for various groups like the Baader-Meinhof group or the Red Army faction in Germany. And you have, of course, the Weather Underground here. And you have a lot of the European and American movements of the 60s were always interesting to me because what they were a representation of people feeling like they no longer had any sort of say in their own government. You know, at the time it was triggered by Vietnam, but you could say that about any sort of aspect of society. And the one reason why I thought that would be useful now is because you look around and people do feel like they have no control over their own government. You know, when you look at Congress and their approval ratings of like, 20%, yet still these people are voted into office every year. What I wanted to do with this, you know, when I first started this book 5 years ago, you know, it wasn't about left versus right in America. It was about that moment of impotence and the frustration that comes from it. And when you feel completely impotent in your own society, what are you willing to do to, just on an emotional level, get rid of that feeling? You know, now people march. When you march, you know, you relieve yourself a little bit of that feeling of powerlessness. And other people will go further. And I think reasonably so. I mean, this idea of these people being radical, they may be, but to me, I sort of understand that impulse and that frustration. And I think a lot of Americans do, just that most people don't have the time in their day to sort of really face up to it and do something as radical as literally step out of your own life. But it's nice to read about people who do make that time.
We're speaking with Olin Steinhauer, and we're talking about his latest book, which is a novel called The Middleman. So you are creating this group called the Massive Brigade. And I think one of the ways, there are a couple of things that are going on which draw hundreds and hundreds of people into this group and which motivate them to take this radical step of stepping dramatically out of their own lives, leaving everything behind, wallet and cell phone and everything, and dropping into the underground, and all on the same day, which of course makes for quite a dramatic gesture. I think one of the most interesting characteristics, and this is from the words of one of the co-leaders of this Massive Brigade, it is when this man named Benjamin talks about how it is time to make America pay for its contempt. And he feels like this is something in which so many elements of society have treated him with contempt over the years. And it is finally time to, in a sense, fire back. Talk more about what you had in mind here in kind of creating this scenario and how many people you think there are out there in society who are feeling a similar sort of pain and anger.
Yeah, well, Benjamin, so you have two people who are the figureheads of this group. One is Martin Bishop, and the other one is Benjamin. And the thing about Benjamin is he's the one who has felt like he's been treated poorly all of his life, and he's the one whose frustration has reached the level of violence. Now, he can reach for violence. He's not the actual head of the group. The face of the group is really Martin, who
right.
is much more peaceful and is trying to shape it into a peaceful movement and trying to make sure that it doesn't verge towards violence. But Benjamin, he's the one who feels that without him, without his threat of violence, Martin's movement would never be able to succeed. He's someone who's been in and out of jail most of his life, and he considers himself one of the forgotten people, one of the kids who fell through the cracks. And for him, that's led to bitterness and anger. Martin is sort of the opposite. He's been successful enough in his life, and he doesn't see it quite the same way. But I found that dichotomy useful for them because I don't think you could represent a movement of dissatisfaction with a peaceful, holy character in a way, which is what Martin is. Martin actually comes from a religious background, and to him there is a religious impulse in trying to help people and change society so that the poorest of them are taken care of. And Benjamin is the one who is in a way less literate with his feelings. He can't put it into nice words, but he knows how to react with his fists. And that tension is, I think, interesting for the group, and it also plays a large part in what goes down in the novel, in the later stages of it.
Absolutely. And it was interesting as we sort of see and sense this tension even within the group, for as much as they might at a glance seem like they are of one purpose, in fact, there is this tension within them that is likely to ultimately tear the group apart. But it reminds me of news reports that or analysis about some upcoming far-right demonstrations that are planned for the near future, and how certain analysts have talked about how, in fact, one of the issues with these groups is that they tend not to work together very well or all that effectively. And of course, that's one of the things that can make these kind of situations and these kind of groups, whether they're far right or far left, especially volatile, is when you kind of are talking about this kind of volatile mix of personalities.
Yeah, it's right. And I think I think it's not just true of these sort of populist movements, whatever they are, far left, far right. But I think it's true of any sort of organization. One reason, why do certain bureaucracies not work well? They have certain rules they're following, which help keep them under control. But at the same time, they're just hundreds or thousands of individuals, each with their own opinion and their own reasons for doing what they're doing. And this is the reason why I say that is because really in most of my books so far, I often represent government agencies of one kind or another, and that's always a thing that comes up in it, is that this agency, whether it's the CIA or, the FSB in Russia, they're not as monolithic as they seem. They are really a collection of flawed human beings, And that's true of government as well as these sort of populist movements.
Right. And you have one of the people involved in this group observing that all of them, that is all of them who are part of this massive brigade, shared a single need that life in America had not satisfied: belonging. They were the misshapen pegs. I think that's a really intriguing way to look at it. And of course, one can see how that sense of frustration could give a tremendous amount of energy, and yet at the same time could also, in a sense, undermine their efforts to try to come together as a group.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this, and I think another character, you know, refers to their group as essentially a collection of special interests. You know, if each misshapen peg is misshapen in its own way, and you know, he can be for saving the whales, she can be for LGBTQ, you know, I can be for, you know, race, equality, anything. But if you put us all together, all these different things can gain one voice, which is still, it's a flawed concept, but sometimes it works.
Right. The thing that was particularly interesting to me was how two members of this group, again, the Massive Brigade, as they were kind of communicating with one another, one of them said, my eyes were already open. I mean, I think referring in this case to something that Martin Bishop had said, and, you know, he said mm-hmm. something and it opened my eyes, and the other person said, my eyes were already open. Most people's are. They just don't know what to do next. What I need is a direction to point myself. So in a sense, we're talking about these people coming together out of sort of collective frustration, and all they need is somebody to, in a sense, point them in a direction, give them some sense of where this frustration and anger and energy should be funneled. And it's just kind of interesting to think about people out there, each in their own lives, not knowing what to do with all of this energy and frustration. And if by chance they take the plunge to become part of a radical group like the Massive Brigade, suddenly there is, in a sense, a target to which to focus their energy and frustration. And that's kind of an unsettling thing to think about.
Well, I think it's sort of what's true for any sort of populist movement. I mean, I think the people who are now very attached to Donald Trump, this is an enormous population, and he comes along, he's very charming, and he can speak to frustrations that they've had for decades. And he gained loyal followers. I don't know that, say, that is really any different than the Massive Brigade. You see this in politics, not just Trump. It's any sort of movement that gains, you know, intense adherence is speaking to something that people weren't able to sort of represent on their own. And to me, it's something you just see regularly in politics. Not regularly enough, I think, but it happens quite a bit. And this, and the Women's March, you know, we went down for that ourselves here in New York. And, you know, you saw people who you can tell by their faces that there was an emotional thing being satisfied in that moment, being surrounded by people who were equally dissatisfied. Now, each person there probably had a slightly different dissatisfaction than everybody else, but they were able to come together under one umbrella and march and feel suddenly as if they belonged.
In this novel, we follow the story through the eyes of four different characters. And it's a very interesting device. And I'm curious, first of all, what draws you to it, and if it's a device that you have used in previous novels as well.
Yeah, I have used that before. And I think part of the reason I always, like if you're following one character through a book, but you're dealing with a large subject, I always find that I have to get the character to do too many unbelievable things to be able to witness the entirety of the situation. And this is why I do this somewhat regularly, is I start cutting the narrative into multiple perspectives, because by the end of the story, some characters will know this much of the elephant. Another character will know this much of the elephant, and there'll be some crossover, but I rarely have one character who knows the entire elephant, if you know what I mean. And I find it a useful way to allow my characters to kind of move along a more natural path and not try to shoehorn them into a place where they have to discover the entire answer. It's something I sort of fell into after my first few books and realizing the limited scope of what they could know, what they could reasonably know.
A last question. One of the really striking moments in the novel, and it comes very quickly, and I've already touched on it briefly, is this notion of, I think it's about 400 people scattered across the country who on a single day each disappear out of their own lives. And only gradually does it become clear that this mass disappearance is tied to this group called the Massive Brigade. And these are members of the Massive Brigade stepping into the underground willingly, all on the same day. It's a fascinating device. Did anything in particular inspire you to kind of create this really dramatic and unsettling event?
I'm trying to think if there's anything in particular. Probably there are some sort of historical precedents of some version sort of inspired this, but a lot of it was the image of someone dropping their telephone and credit cards into a trash can.
Yes.
Once I had that, I thought, okay, I have to use this somehow. And it's just, I am a slave to my telephone. I'm a slave to the constant messages, the news alerts, and everything like that. And the credit card, you're a slave to the banks in a way. You can put it that way. And this was about getting rid of all the control so that finally someone is just a human being walking around in the world. And that seemed like I liked the image. And, of course, just having one person disappear is not very interesting. So we made it 400. I made it 400. And then, of course, you have to spend the rest of the novel explaining how could this highly unlikely event happen. And hopefully the book does that.
Right. You have one of the characters, as they are engaging in this moment, feeling a strange sense of lightness as they leave behind, in a sense, their life and their world for this new life that they are about to undertake. And one other intriguing line I want to just quickly mention is when you have a character who is part of this massive brigade kind of confronting this notion that perhaps they will be engaging in violence and perhaps massive and terrible violence, that the whole notion of terrorism is only terrorism when you are terrorizing the masses. But when you are using such acts to terrorize the leaders, the elite, that's something else. That's not terrorism. That's something else. It's something more important. It's something more noble. And it's really interesting to think about the way in which people can twist what they are doing and see it through the most sort of positive, affirming lens.
Exactly. Yeah, everything is justified because none of us are none of us see ourselves as the bad guy ever. You know, everything we do, everything, you know, I don't want to reach for like a Hitler analogy, but essentially anyone who does bad things in the moment, they do not think they're doing anything bad. I think that's true. Actually, I haven't quizzed everybody in prison, but I think that's generally the case. We're remarkable creatures for justifying our own actions. I know I do it all the time.
Right. We see the right and ignore the wrong of what we have done. Well, this novel is so intriguing and full of some shocking turns. And again, it's titled The Middleman. It is published by Minotaur Books and the author, Olin Steinhauer. Olin Steinhauer, I have really enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about your fascinating novel.
Too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And the time is 8:40. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. And here is part two. Marvelous music almost needs no introduction. It is An American in Paris of the great George Gershwin. That's one of the pieces that is going to be played this Friday night for what promises to be an extra special edition of the Lakeside Pops, which, of course, is a longtime marvelous musical tradition in the city of Racine, presented by the Racine Symphony Orchestra at Festival Hall. But what makes Friday night's concert extra special and something uncommon is the fact that a number of different local musicians and artists are going to be featured, and that's why the concert is called Racine Live. And I'm very, very happy to be able to spend a few minutes talking with the music director of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, Pasquale Larino, to talk about how Friday night's concert has been put together and what sorts of musical treasures people can expect if they attend Friday night's concert, which is 7 o'clock at Racine's Festival Hall. Pasquale Larino, we welcome you back to the morning show.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you, Greg.
Glad to be talking with you. So I'm anxious for you, first of all, to kind of spell out this notion of Racine Live and the really interesting local connection that or variety of local connections that are going to be featured on Friday night's concert. Tell us a bit about this idea and how it was implemented.
Well, we thought that perhaps in our presentation of our concerts through the normal channels, we were missing some of the grassroots musical elements in the community, people that might not think of or have an opportunity to present their talents to us, and we in turn presenting them to our audience. So we cast a large net, and we solicited people to make submissions through YouTube to audition for the chance to play or sing with the orchestra. And we came up with some very interesting combination of instrumentalists and singers who might not otherwise be performing with us.
Absolutely. And I know because I'm doing a little work with a couple of the people who are on this program that I know at least some of them have absolutely never in their lives performed with an orchestra before. So it's hard to even conceive of what an exciting opportunity this is for them and for you and for the audience.
Well, yes, we're very excited, especially to be able to include younger instrumentalists and singers who might not have thought about being given a chance with an orchestra. Certainly, our young strings group singers that you mentioned or alluded to earlier, singing the duet from tonight, the Side Story, are excellent examples of very young talent, probably not far from the actual ages, that would be singing, but rarely do perform this wonderful work of Bernstein, and our nod to his centennial this year.
Fantastic. So tell us a little about some of the other local musicians who are going to be playing a role in Friday night's concert one way or another.
Well, our in-house musician, Eric Carlson, has been our keyboardist for years. And in discussion with him, I told him that I was very interested in featuring one of his original compositions with the orchestra. So he orchestrated it specifically for our forces with us in mind, that he could play the piano solo, a work he calls Missing You. But it also is a very talented keyboardist and wanted to show off that aspect of his talent. And so he'll also be playing the Liszt Liebestraum. A third component to his artistry is his ability to extemporaneously come up with music, a skill that many composers and arrangers have. And we're going to present him with this opportunity to do so live in front of our audience, taking audience's suggestions in terms of musical style, maybe even down to the notes that he'll use, or whether he'll be in a major or a minor key, and then taking those suggestions, working up, building a composition that will present in some form in a matter of minutes in front of the audience. So this should be a very revealing and hopefully very entertaining opportunity for our audience to have an insider's look into what a composer does.
Wow. Is this something that the Racine Symphony has ever done before? And is this something, exactly this, something that Eric Carlson has ever done before?
To my knowledge, we have never done it before, certainly not in my tenure. And I think this is also something that Eric is anxious to try, but I'm giving the impression that this will really be a first time for him. So it will be a very exciting opportunity, but as is the case in anything that's performed live, anything can happen. And so we hope we'll have a successful result.
Right. Well, Eric is certainly an immensely talented musician. So I think there's every likelihood that something really wonderful is going to emerge from all of that. So that sounds quite exciting. Tell us about some of the other Racine musicians who are going to be part of Friday night's concert.
We're also excited to have a very talented Lachelle Newkirk singing Summertime from Porgy and Bess. One thing will probably surprise people when they come. We're doing the famous Cacciatorian Saber Dance on the program, and Angel Laurie is going to be featured as a soloist on the steel drum for this particular piece. And again, steel drum and symphony orchestras, you don't necessarily hear. Clearly, Cacciatorian did not write this piece for the steel drum, but we thought it would be a very interesting composition that would work very well for her to play on this unusual instrument in a concert setting.
Wow.
So that will be great. We also make a more traditional nod with the delightful Puccini aria from Gianni Schicchi, O mio bambino caro, sung by Mary Catherine Bach.
Excited about that because she is a Carthage graduate, and I have worked with her in our opera workshop. And so I know firsthand what a fine voice she has and how exciting that's going to be.
Well, she has a wonderful voice, and actually, when she made the audition, I was very, very impressed with her facility. She sang a marvelous but very obscure Donizetti aria for her audition, and unfortunately, we couldn't find the music for that, and we had to go with something in our library, something that will certainly be familiar to our audience members. Really, one of the most performed vignettes of Puccini, so we're delighted to have her in this little cameo on this concert. Another unusual instrument for as a soloist is John Knepper will be playing the Rimsky-Korsakov Concerto for Trombone, another solo instrument that we don't normally hear with the symphony orchestra, and we're delighted that John will be sharing his talents with us.
Very good. John Knepper, who's a very well-known music educator in the Kenosha-Racine area. And you're right, that's an instrument that's not often in the spotlight, not typically. Does that
unless you have 76 trombones.
There you go. And does that kind of finish out then the musical lineup for Friday night's concert?
Pretty much. Of course, we start with a wonderful overture of sorts, the March Slav of Tchaikovsky, which will get everybody's blood churning, the orchestras especially, with the challenges of that piece. And we finish up, I think, any summer should include a trip to Paris. So we'll end with the terrific American in Paris suite of George Gershwin.
Great. I know that you are having, I believe, two rehearsals with these guest artists and the orchestra. I wonder if you can just say a word about the kind of challenge that confronts you as the conductor to put all this together, particularly a concert that is this complex.
Well, yes, in fact, it is a challenge just to get all of the component parts to be able to use everyone's time as efficiently as possible, to be able to, with performers perhaps who are not used to playing with orchestra, to understand how the component parts fit together. It will feel very much different to them singing or playing in front of an orchestra than it does, than it feels in a practice room or when accompanied by just a piano. So all of this will be part of the learning curve for these young performers, and we have two rehearsals to do that. The finished product is happening on Friday, and I'm sure I have confidence in each and every one of them that they'll be up for the task.
Absolutely. So we want to remind people that this last Lakeside Pops concert of the season is Friday night at 7 p.m. at Racine's Festival Hall, with the doors opening at 5:30. And what should people know if someone has never been to a Lakeside Pops concert before in terms of where they go or what's offered or what the evening typically is like?
Well, first of all, I'm very surprised because I get to concert venues very, very rarely, but our audiences seem to beat me to the door every single time. People arrive early, they come, they enjoy the fellowship of being together, having a meal together. I think the doors open at 5:30, and they're usually there right on the dot to be able to share this time together with friends, and for many of them it becomes a regular ritual. So consequently, if anyone gets a little bit closer to the concert time at 7 o'clock, they may find it a little bit challenging to find parking near the venue. So to get there early is always a good idea. We do have the benefit of having the Young Strings performing for us in a pre-concert, so they will have music accompanying their pre-concert meals for this particular performance, and we're excited about that, and our audiences should be able to enjoy the fine work of these young string players as they test their skills playing some dinner music.
Right. Before before the concert itself begins at 7. And we want to remind people that the address of the website for the Racine Symphony is racinesymphony.org, and otherwise you can call their office at 636-9285, and someone friendly will help you secure your tickets, and it probably is a good idea to take care of your tickets ahead of time if you can. Of course, beyond Friday night, then, a new Masterwork series of concerts begins. And I wanted to give you a chance to just say a quick word about a name that jumped out at me as I looked at your first classical season concert on Saturday, October 6th. One of the pieces is going to feature the Racine Symphony's artist-in-residence, Jeremiah Frederick. Tell our listeners about him and about what it means for a group like the Racine Symphony to have an artist-in-residence.
Well, the artist-in-residence program is one of the real hallmarks of the organization. I'm so pleased that they have sponsored an artist to come into the community to work a full week in the schools and performing in various venues around the city, from some underserved communities through senior centers to places that business people go to lunch, and everything from soup to nuts. Every year it's a little bit different in terms of the venues that they perform in, or the opportunities that they have to interface with students in the elementary school, going all the way through college master classes. And Jeremiah is a very distinguished French hornist who have had a number of opportunities to work with in the Chicago area where he hails from. I'm just delighted that we'll be able to have him on this Mozart Horn Concerto with the orchestra in October.
Hmm. Very, very good. I also couldn't help but notice that towards the end of the season, you'll be in the soloist spotlight at one point, and I know that's something that people always appreciate.
Well, indeed, it's an opportunity for me to rosin up the bow a little bit and play with the orchestra, which is always a pleasure. You know, at a certain point, you after you know telling the orchestra what to do, they enjoy the experience. Okay, well,
very good.
And because the baton, as you know, is silent, so it's a chance to join my friends and colleagues in the orchestra and to play this lovely romance of Vinyevsky on the spring concert.
Marvelous. So lots to look forward to from the Racine Symphony Orchestra, and more information about the entire season and all the concerts can be found easily on the website, racinesymphony.org. And otherwise, again, you can call their office at 636-9285. And we want to remind everybody of Friday night's concert, the last of the Lakeside Pops concerts this summer at Racine's Festival Hall, featuring the Racine Symphony Orchestra and array of talented Racinians in the soul spotlight. And, of course, on the podium, Pasquale Larino. Maestro, it was great to speak with you again. Good luck to you and the orchestra and all of your talented soloists for Friday night's concert. And thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Greg. Thank you.
It's 8:59 here on WGTD, and tomorrow on the morning show, I am excited to share with you a conversation with a faculty colleague from Carthage College Dr. Thomas Knorr, Professor Emeritus of History, talking about his book Soapy, about a really intriguing, unconventional political figure named C. Menin Williams, a very wealthy individual who cut political ties with his wealthy family and became one of the most significant progressive voices of his generation. So we learn about Soapy from Dr. Thomas Knorr on tomorrow's morning show. And on Friday, Beneath the Sands of